The Ukraine-Russia war has become largely deadlocked on the ground because of saturation, drone surveillance and strike capability. There is a race to break that deadlock, and that's one reason why Ukraine wants Storm Shadow missiles and why the Prime Minister has just handed them the final part of the blueprints. At the same time, a new RUSI analysis reveals how Russia's shifted its reliance from mass firepower to mass precision strike. So who will win this race and what will it mean for the future of this war, Mike?
Well, it's changing in tactics, Sian, as you'd expect after 4.5 years. It's not as stalemated as people think. And both sides are now changing tactics as they struggle to break through the drone walls. And there has been some success for both sides in this. But ultimately, we're at a stage where the war will be decided not by what happens on the battlefield, but what happens more strategically.
Storm Shadow is potentially quite an important weapon, but we need to do a little bit of expectation management.
Defence Explained.
The war is now one of endurance and of production. It's not one on the battlefield.
This is SITREP with Sian Greschek Melbourne and Professor Michael Clark.
Well, there are some other important elements that we will talk about. The visit to Moscow by the director of the CIA, President Zelensky talking about a new ceasefire plan, and Andy Burnham confirming he will join other European leaders in the US in the coming days to lobby President Trump. But to make sense of that growing diplomatic hum, it helps to understand the military picture. Mike, I was looking at some numbers this week from the Harvard Kennedy School in the US. Their latest four-week analysis estimates Russia achieved a net gain of just 24 square miles at a cost of 8 to 12,000 Russian deaths and more than 1,000 Ukrainian lives. You look at numbers like that, in a way it feels unsustainable, and yet it feels hard to see it changing anytime soon.
Yeah, that's true. And I mean, against that, the Ukrainians are claiming that they have taken 750 kilometres down in the south in Dnipropetrovsk and in Zaporizhia, and of course 16,000 Russian casualties. And although that 16,000 number over the course of 2 to 3 months isn't actually that high in terms of the average of the number of troops they're losing, it shows that they are being pushed back, but they're not being beaten. As such, they're withdrawing in good order, more or less, from where the Ukrainians have managed to push them. So both sides are making gains, both sides are taking losses on the battlefield, but they can't really break through the stranglehold of drones, except locally. Locally, they have broken through. But they can't break through strategically because the drones have got a grip on this war, as they have on every other war. The fact is, drones prolong the fighting. It happens throughout Africa. It happens in the Middle East. The revolution, if that's what it is, the arrival of drones in high numbers and low cost actually prolongs conflict.
Well, neither Ukraine nor Russia is simply hoping more of the same will lead to their victory. Let's focus in first on this deal allowing Ukraine to build its own version of the Storm Shadow missile, also known as Scalp by France. Could these missiles eventually enable Ukraine to fight in a different way that might break the deadlock that you're talking about?
Well, if they have enough of them, what these missiles do, they strike behind the lines, so they can strike the logistics bases, forces coming forward, fixed targets and so on. So they can, as we prepare the battlefield, they can make it much harder for another side to react. So they could be, if in sufficient numbers, they could be part of a big push to actually break through the drone wall, as I call it. But, you know, we're talking in First World War terms here, to prepare a battlefield, to push through the front line and then exploit the gap that you've created. At the moment, that is kind of where they both sides are. And although they are making progress in that, strategically, there is nothing really new about that. And Storm Shadow will be, if in big enough numbers, a pretty efficient way of preparing the battlefield and preparing an offensive so the other side finds it very hard to react quickly enough.
And of course, you know, it's not something that can happen overnight. These things take a long time, don't they? With us on SITREP this time, we welcome back retired Royal Navy Captain John Foreman, who served as British military attaché to Ukraine and then Russia. Also with us is Dr. Thomas Withington, a senior non-resident associate fellow at the NATO Defence College and associate fellow at the Royal United Services Institute. Hello to you. Tom, how well set up is Ukraine to turn these blueprints into actual missiles in meaningful numbers? And how long is it going to take?
Well, I would echo what Mike mentioned just now. I mean, Storm Shadow is potentially quite an important weapon, but we need to do a little bit of expectation management here. So firstly, as your question suggested, you need to have the industrial capability to build the missile in the numbers that are required to have operational impact, so to cause the Russians significant harm. Now, in order to do that, remember, Ukraine's a country at war, so having one or two factories where you build large numbers of Storm Shadows becomes very risky because these are going to be prestige targets for the Russians. So you have to disperse production as best you possibly can. But the more you disperse production of something, the longer that production takes. For instance, if you're building, you know, the guidance system in one place, the motor somewhere else, the fuselage in a third location, obviously you've got to bring all of those components together at some point. So that's the first issue. The second issue is you've got to then have the necessary personnel who can build the missiles in volume. Now, to be fair to Ukraine, one of the things they've shown is their enviable ability to turn capability, well, to turn capability into high production volumes. And I've seen this myself when I've been out there. So that's going to be a relatively easy thing for the Ukrainians to do. But you still need to train people. You still need to set up production lines. And then once you've done all of that, you then need to get the missiles into the hands of the people who use them. So I would argue that there's very rarely in war is there one technology that is going to lead to a victory by one side. Scalp and Storm Shadow is certainly important, very important. But I think we need to be cognizant that this is going to take some time. It hopefully will be a contributing factor to an eventual Ukrainian victory. But it's not likely, sadly, to turn the tables overnight.
John, just picking up on Tom's first point there about dispersal, you know, some people might think, why are we asking them to make missiles in a country that is under attack every night? Why don't we just make them for Ukraine?
Yeah, well, I agree. I think Tom's point's right. I think the Ukrainians have got a lot of expertise actually distributing production. I think what's quite interesting is although the Russians have been trying to target Ukrainian military industrial sites, they actually haven't been successful. That's successful. So I think the numbers, some have told me, went from 10 production sites or companies in 2022 to maybe 1,500 now. And we're seeing, you know, in Ukraine's own production and things like Flamingo and, you know, Farpoint missiles and drones, is actually the production numbers are ramping up as funding comes from Europe and actually they're gaining greater skills. So I see Storm Shadow as another string to the Ukrainian bow. I don't see it as a game changer. I think it's going to enable Ukraine to strike key strategic targets within a certain range, because the version given to the Ukrainians is limited down from, so we say, the Anglo-French version down to something which is compliant with a thing called the MCTR, which, you know, that regulates medium-range missile, conventional missiles. But I think also on Storm Shadow, it's quite a sophisticated weapon. And there were concerns expressed by experts better than me that it will take time for this sort of exquisite weapon to be developed and produced. And I think ongoing support from MBDA, technical support, expert support to get it out the door and into the hands of the warfighter is going to be important.
Mike, does Ukraine want Storm Shadow for targets in Ukraine or Russia, or is it both?
Oh, it will be both. It's, I mean, targets behind the front line. So by definition, some of those are in the Donbass, in Donetsk, Luhansk, and in Zaporizhia, and Kherson, I mean, half of that. So, you know, in the occupied territories, there are obviously fixed sites that the Ukrainians would want to go after. And legally, of course, there's no problem with that, because that is Ukraine's own territory, occupied. So in a way, they can do what they like in that territory without any issue. But they also want to go after sites inside Russia, I mean, particularly in Belgorod and Rostov and so on, places like that, where the Russians do build up their forces and their logistics prior to sending them over the border. So yes, I mean, Storm Shadow, this version will have a range of about 150 miles, so what, 230-odd kilometers, something like that. Not a huge range, but enough to get behind the front lines and cause problems for any force trying to organize an offensive. That's really what it does.
Can I just add? I think it's important that the French and the British approach is changing to try and give weapons to the Ukrainians which don't have American intellectual property in it. And that's really crucial. We know there's another competition in place issued by the Ministry of Defense to give these weapons to missiles to Ukraine without American information in it. I think it's important given the sort of, say, the wobbliness and the capriciousness of the Trump administration in supporting Ukraine. So I think that's another part of the strategy. I see Storm Shadow as the evolution of our British strategy to give the weapons to Ukraine to defend itself, which has been really in place since before the invasion.
Yeah, I think John's absolutely right. There's this Project Breakstop that you'll know a fair bit about. I mean, it started off with an MOD competition, you know, and they specified what had to be created with a missile. And I think there were over 100 companies were interested, and it's come down to four or five companies competing to meet these requirements. But the requirement that is, I think, isn't specified in the initial terms, but is absolutely crucial, is that anything they produce must not have any American components in it. And that is, I mean, you wouldn't have believed that that would be the case 5 or 10 years ago, but here we are. That's where it is.
I think there's two ways as well. So just to make that point is that, you know, us helping Ukraine defend itself and issuing contracts like Breakstop also gives us the opportunity to get more deeper strike capabilities into British armed forces, which obviously then builds deterrence against Russia.
Well, the handover of tech isn't one way. Simon Newton told us around 3 months ago about this vast library of training data from Ukrainian drones, something like 220 years worth of footage, and how it might be made available to the UK. That partnership with Ukraine's Avengers AI Labs was indeed signed when the Prime Minister was in Kyiv. Mike, it's been described as a treasure trove of military data. It's interesting that they've chosen the UK as the first to get it. And I wonder if it offers an opportunity for what we do with that data to help Ukraine as well as ourselves.
Oh, for sure. I mean, it is gold dust, this stuff. It's the universal military data set. And Britain's been given first dibs on it, in effect, partly because they trust us. And we've got a very good AI sector. So scientifically, we're the best in Europe at AI. We are equivalent to the United States, at least not the science of it, not the application or the investment into it. But, you know, we're pretty good with AI. And the point is that this is data to train AI models that they can be applied then to warfare and security in general. The Americans train their AI models with simulation material, which is okay, but is not as accurate. This is an absolute treasure trove. So, I mean, this universal military data set is taking in about 100,000 drone videos every month and about 50,000 locations of Russian military equipment every month. And I was working out that if you look at the way it must have ramped up since 2022, 23, but if you allow for the ramping, I think they must have about 4 million pieces of information from their drones. And it's not just the drones footage that you see on social media, the end part, it's the whole thing from start to finish. In addition to all the acoustic sensors, the intelligence reports, everything that they've got, it is a technical history of a war that has been going on for 4.5 years. And it is gold dust as a population of material to train AI models on stuff that is real. Absolutely not simulated, it is real. So potentially, this is really very advantageous.
I mean, I completely agree that the gold dust aspect is a really good analogy. I mean, in my sector, in electronic warfare and radar and these kind of things, one of the things very interesting with what Ukraine's been doing is that every time it mounts these attacks against targets within Russia, it is flying against the Russian integrated air defense system. Now, that integrated air defense system is arguably the most comprehensive and probably the densest in the world. But every night, the Ukrainians are proving that they can get through it and they can hit targets. They lose missiles and drones during that process, but they can nevertheless hit targets. If, heavens forbid, we find ourselves in a war with Russia, we are at least going to be in the advantageous position where we have terabits worth of data on how that air defense system behaves so that we can hopefully fly through it relatively unscathed and hit the targets that we need to. So this is another really important aspect of what the Ukrainians are collecting. And the appetite for that data, you know, as you can imagine, is vociferous.
And diplomatically, if the Ukrainians are giving it to us, does that mean that we're also sharing that with the US?
Well, I mean, I would, above my pay grade, I have to say on whether that's actually taking place. I think one of the things you've seen is that, and I've seen this on the ground as well, is that there is a significant level of cooperation between Ukraine and her allies, which can include the US as well, despite the tensions that we saw, obviously, with President Trump and President Zelensky in the past. Military to military level, the cooperation has been very, very strong. Everyone benefits from this.
I think the bottom line on this, Sean, is that the professionals in the Pentagon take this universal military data set very seriously, but the top of the Pentagon don't, because they don't take terribly seriously anything that comes out of Ukraine, on the assumption that Ukraine is somehow militarily backward, doing its best, and so on. They don't appreciate, I think, just how innovative Ukraine has proved to be. But the professionals know it, but nobody's kind of listening to them just at the moment.
What's your take, John?
Well, I think the Ukraine sharing the AI database is putting, you know, meat on the bones of our 100-year partnership, which we signed a couple of years ago. And I think it's, you know, proof that, as I said, things are going two-way here. You know, AI was put at the heart of the Strategic Defense Review and Defense Investment Plan to improve our lethality, to improve our ISR, to drive down decision-making times, to drive down the time between finding something and striking it. You know, we've seen the Americans using AI in their prosecution of the war in Iran. So this is what we have to do. And I think, you know, if it's done correctly, especially also the Ukrainians are on doing using autonomy, not just, you know, AI for decision making, actually autonomy into the drones itself, I think it's a huge win for us. As Mike says, we have a huge advantage, I think, in Europe on AI, not just on the safety side, but on its application. And I think the British Armed Forces can get ahead of that. It actually starts to show that we can be leaner, but much, much more violent. And again, it contributing to deterrence, which ultimately what's the goal, is to stop Russia doing anything daft.
I love the concept of being leaner but more violent. It conjures up all sorts of images in my mind.
It's like me in the, gym.
Yeah, leaner but violent, yes.
But no, I think the idea is, yeah, the small armed forces are not going to get huge. Yeah. So rather than saying taking X hours to find a strike target, if it takes minutes, you get much more bang for your buck. And also, like, at the same time, if you're driving down production costs as well and getting the smartness in the machine, in the technology, in the missiles up, I think it's a win-win.
I like your embrace of the maneuverist mindset there, John.
It's interesting what you said, Mike, there about you not thinking that the Americans value this in the same way that we see the value in that. But coming back to Storm Shadow, Tom, it isn't the first military technology we've handed over to Ukraine. I know you've talked to our colleague Tom Sables a couple of weeks back about Stone Cloak, which helps missiles evade detection. What other technology could we and should we be sharing that might help give Ukraine a deadlock breaking edge?
Well, it's a good question. I think, certainly, again, in my domain of electronic warfare, we're sharing quite a bit. I think we're probably sharing as much as we can at the moment. Obviously, we can always do better. I mean, a thing that I hear coming back from my Ukrainian counterparts when I talk to them is, kit is really nice, you know, great. Thanks for giving us kit. It's hugely appreciated. But often what the Ukrainians are saying to me is, look, where we need help is in things like scaling up production, is in making production leaner, more efficient, getting good industrial practices into production facilities, that kind of thing. And that sort of stuff, you know, helping to make the production process, if you like, the defense industrial complex, military industrial complex, rather, as efficient as possible is vitally important. So I think, you know, we can't do enough of that. And I would certainly like to see a lot more of that going into Ukraine. I mean, it is happening. It is going into the country. But I would stress it's not just about the kit. It's also about how to improve industrial processes. And if we can get on top of both of those things, I mean, that becomes a war-winning strategy in its own right, actually. You just need to look at the Second World War to see that. So that's an important part of it for me.
But speed and agility has never been synonymous with military procurement or processes, has it? And that's at the heart. That's at the heart of all of our, many of our problems, isn't it?
Well, people, you know, you make a good point there, Sean, actually. I mean, people say that, but you don't have to look that far back in history to see actually when we need to do it, we can be pretty good at procurement, actually. I mean, World War II is the classic one, you know, black and white pictures of factories in the Midlands churning out Spitfires and all of this stuff. I was at a conference recently and someone was saying to me, oh, but it's just, you know, but that Spitfires. The Spitfire was the most, one of the most advanced aircraft of its time at that point, and we were manufacturing them in the hundreds. More recently, during the global war on terror in places like Afghan and Iraq, in terms of what we did with counter-IED technology, we proved that we could scale up very rapidly and get that technology into the hands of the men and women who need it. So it is possible to do it. It's like anything, it's political will and expenditure. And John's point that he made earlier about Taurus, I think, is a good example of that. You know, that I would argue that's a question of German political will. You know, the missiles are there. Just take the decision to supply them. You know, that the rest will sort of fall into place.
Tom, what's the risk here that Russia will get hold of our sensitive military tech, either through leaking of blueprints or reverse engineering captured kit?
There's always a risk, but in something like Storm Shadow, Storm Shadow is a very sophisticated weapon, but it's a weapon that's 20 years old now, or a design that's, you know, 20 plus years old. So it's one, I could get the blueprints to a Bentley car. I wouldn't necessarily be able to build it. You know, I'd need the bits and pieces. I'd need the components. Crucially, I'd need the software. That's one of the big things these days. You know, I would need the processing and software. Russia is still having to buy chips from Korean, Thai, and American suppliers on the international black market. That tells me there's something very badly wrong in the Russian semiconductor industry. Russia is a country full of very good engineers, excellent scientists. They should not be needing to buy advanced chips on the international black market, but they still are. So it's one thing to get the blueprints. I mean, the risk, of course, is that you then realize the missile's weaknesses, you realize ways that you may be able to engage it. But you have to weigh that risk up against the risk of doing nothing. And in many ways, if Russia reverses a Storm Shadow to build, well, you know, I mean, it, I wouldn't say it's taking a step backwards, but that's providing it with a subsonic cruise missile. It's already building subsonic cruise missiles. But from a defensive point of view, that is something we need to think about. But you've got to outweigh the risk of doing nothing, I think.
I'd be surprised if the Russians didn't know all about Storm Shadow makes it work, because they've got some. I mean, in the sense that they've come down inside Russia and there's bits of debris that they can get, and that reportedly they've shot a couple down that have been used. So I'd be surprised if they didn't know how it works. But as Tom said, whether they could reproduce it themselves or whether they would want to when they've got their own missile production runs is a different question.
Well, let's look more widely at the question I posed at the start about breaking the battlefield deadlock. Mike, you've said before the drones are effectively stopping manoeuvre, and whichever side wants to make a breakthrough needs to get back to manoeuvre. How can they make that happen?
Well, a bit of that has happened. The Ukrainians started an offensive down in the southwest of their area, southwest of Ukraine, southeast of their operational area around Dnipropetrovsk. And they started at the beginning of February, just as Elon Musk took down Starlink for the Russians, and that made a big difference. And they managed to break through the drone wall for a while, using sort of heavy bomber drones as top cover. And they actually got through with about seven different brigades. So I think there was the 78th, the 79th, the 80th, the 82nd, which is the brigade, the 82nd Air Assault Brigade is the one that's got a lot of the British equipment in it, like the Challenger 2 tanks, the 95th. And then they had a couple of assault brigades. I think they had the 1st and the 425th. I counted seven brigades using traditional methods, as it were, to break through, and they claim to have taken 750 square kilometers. Now, that offensive ran out of steam, as it was bound to do, as offensives like that always do, because, you know, you're going forward, the opposition are not broken, they're just withdrawing in good order, so they're going back on their own communication line, so they get stiffer. But that offensive ran until about the middle of this month. And then it's become clear that another offensive has taken place in the north. The Russians have been trying to create a pincer movement, a big pincer movement against Slavyansk and Kramatorsk, which are the two places they really want to capture in the next few months. And they were trying to get to insulate or get round Lyman in the north. If they could surround Lyman north of Slavyansk, then they could create this pincer, then turn southwards. The Ukrainians outmaneuvered them and outflanked them at a village, small town called Nova. And again, the Ukrainians look as if they've used the 77th Air Assault Brigade and the 60th, 66th Assault Brigades, again, using conventional methods. That appears to have either run out of steam or is taking a pause. We don't know. But you can see here, there's a couple of examples of the Ukrainians making some significant gains. Now, again, this is not going to break the deadlock, but what both of their offensives may have done is buy time for Slavyansk and Kramatorsk. It's very hard to imagine the Russians being able to move into those areas, certainly before the winter. So more likely, it's bought time for them until next spring. And that's a tactical, it's kind of a semi-strategic victory, if you like. It matters to the map. And it certainly matters to commanders on the ground. So, you know, you can break through the drone walls, but you can only do it by more drones. So it's very much like First World War thinking. If you can overwhelm the enemy at one point and then pour through the gap, you will get some benefit, but only some. And that's really the problem that we have with the war. The war is moving to a different strategic level of homeland-to-homeland bombardment with drones and ballistic missiles. That's where the war will go for the next year or two, which is why it's getting more and more dangerous. And the issue for the Ukrainians is, and it's really hard to say this to Ukrainian personnel, if you like, is that you have to keep on fighting. You have to, because you can't win this war on the battlefield, but by God, you could lose it there. And that's the issue. You mustn't lose the war on the battlefield, but you've got to win it in some other different way. And that's really hard to say to people whose, you know, sons and husbands are on the front line.
Yeah, Tom, you're nodding there.
Yeah, I have a question, actually, Mike, John, for the two of you, if I may, because we do talk about the First World War quite a bit for understandable reasons. I was wondering for both of you, what do you think about the Iran-Iraq War as an analogy as well? Because I definitely see parallels there, particularly the War of the Cities. And then this thing of one side realizing, okay, we didn't have the drones then, but right, we need to get this war mobile. That's the thing.
I don't think the war is going to go mobile. I think the Ukraine's on defensive strategically, trying to basically stop the Russians grinding their way forward. The Russians are still very much trying to target the Donbass. I think the World War One analogy is a bit overused, to be honest, because that conjures up trenches. Actually, there are no trenches now. So you have people in front of you, on the side of you, in the rear of you. It's a very fluid space either side of the front line. I think the problem the Ukrainians have got is manpower. They are significantly at a disadvantage to the Russian side of manpower, even though the Ukrainians are killing an awful lot of Russians. So the Ukrainians are using drones to sort of compensate for the lack of manpower. The problem is, of course, then that the Russians could target the drone operators, which then has a disproportionate effect and could cause local breakthroughs. I think the key factor for me is that the war is now one of endurance and of production. It's not one on the battlefield. I think the Ukrainians have to stem the breach, hold firm up to the winter when the infiltration tactics stop becoming so effective because there's no cover. But I think the Russians themselves have made ground, and where they want to make ground is towards the cities. And I am concerned about the area to the east of Slavyansk, Kramatorsk. And that's why I think the new chief of the army, Dripathi, has come in, and he's there basically to sort that out, because the Russians are making gains gradually, which the Ukrainians under the previous, a team couldn't stem. And I think, Putin, his number one priority on the battlefield is to get to the limits of Donetsk, because he has to get there to have any form of, quote, victory to show to the Russian people.
Mike, let's have a look at this analysis by Siddharth Kaushal and Sam Cranny-Evans at RUSI, saying that Russia has evolved from relying on massed artillery firepower to greatly expanded precision strike capabilities. What's the effect of that? Does it offer the potential for Russia to break the deadlock, or is it part of the cause?
No, it's part of the cause. I mean, what the Russians have done, because they've improved, as the Ukrainians certainly have, and they're less dependent now on conventional artillery, though they still use a lot of it. They're still firing off, you know, 10 and 15,000 shells a day, some days, but usually it's a bit lower than that. And the Ukrainians are firing off, you know, 3, 4,000 a day where they can. So there's still a lot of artillery being used. But because drones are now so accurate, then they're like a better form of artillery if you've got enough of them. And the Russians have evolved their tactics to create, you know, big precision effects, which is what you would expect them to do. It does mean that the Ukrainians, therefore, can't concentrate. They can't. It's harder for them to make a breakthrough, which is why all they can do is try and punch a small hole in an area and then send some armor through for a limited time. That's about as much as the Ukrainians can manage. But they've done that very well, even though they've taken losses in doing it. So I don't think, I mean, I understand the Russian analysis. I think it's a very good one. But I don't think it's strategically going to change what fundamentally happens on the ground.
Tom, one way, at least theoretically, for Ukraine to break deadlock might be electronic warfare supremacy. If it can significantly hamper Russia's ability to accurately target, then that maneuver could happen again. How much hope does either side have of achieving that?
That's a good question. I mean, the spectrum battle at the moment, so the battle in the electromagnetic spectrum, I think it's safe to say is as chaotic as it was back in February 2022, and then back even further from 2014 onwards. So the way I see this is that the victory in the spectrum, so gaining electromagnetic superiority as a first step to electromagnetic supremacy, so that by that definition, I mean you deprive the enemy of the ability to use the spectrum as they wish, either in a particular place, over a particular time, or to do particular tasks. Now, whichever side loses that or loses the ability to achieve that will almost certainly lose the conflict. But at the same time, victory in the spectrum will not bring victory on its own. It will be a very important part of that. One of the things we're seeing, particularly if you look at things like communications in Russia at the moment, is Russia has had endless tactical communications problems since this war began. They started this war in a situation where they were modernizing the communications of their land forces, and they were modernizing their communications with radio systems that were effectively not fit for purpose and could not backwards communicate with older systems. This caused untold problems. They've never got over those problems. John mentioned Starlink earlier on. The deprivation of Starlink for Russia, which it was using illicitly, had a profound effect on Russian operational level communications and tactical communications. And again, they've never quite got over this. Ukraine has to win the battle in the spectrum. I think Ukraine can win the battle at the spectrum if Ukraine is going to win the war. But that is, you know, that is a slog. I mean, much as it is on the ground, much as it is in the air, it's a slog in the spectrum as well. And UAVs have changed everything with that, because so much of the effort now, 80%, I'm told, the electronic warfare effort at the tactical level in Ukraine is on drone and counter-drone activity. And that is just going to continue. But that comes back to the point I made earlier about the importance. You know, we're very good in the UK at supplying EW capability into Ukraine. And we need to continue doing that, and we need to look at how we can improve that further by things like industrial, you know, assisting Ukrainian industry to get the capability it needs. But the spectrum battle is absolutely essential to victory for Ukraine.
Yeah, we'll talk more about the battlefield in a bit, but I just want to turn our attention to some of the top-level talking that's been going on. Mike, the CIA director's visit to Moscow this week, I know his travel plans are generally not published, but still quite a surprise. What's your take on it?
Yeah, it was very interesting, wasn't it? We saw a C-17 going into Moscow, and then the director of the CIA gets out. And the Russian official statement was that President Putin was informed. Well, I should think he was. An American aircraft flies into Moscow and the director of the CIA steps out. And the first question was, why such a big aircraft for one person? The answer seems to be this roll-on, roll-off conference capsule, which is the CIA director can run the whole CIA operation from a capsule inside the aircraft, which you just put onto it, which is, you know, hardened against espionage or scanning or any hacking or anything. And so that was why it was a C-17, so that he could have his conference capsule.
But, I mean, also, can I just say, just on that, Mike, when we brought Ben Wallace and Tony Radek into Moscow in 2022, we chose the biggest aircraft we could possibly send there to send the message. And when we got to the airport, this thing, sort of this Voyager, trundles up, the big Union Jack on the back. And the Russian general said he's never seen such a big aircraft from foreign delegation. So it's sort of to set the image, not just, you know. Yeah, and then the Russian saw this, the sheer aircraft, the Americans saw this thing landing in and saying, look, we're under attack from the Russian Americans.
I bet we didn't have a conference capsule or anything like it, though, did we? I mean, I shouldn't imagine
the whole,
we do.
No, but the whole aircraft was
capable
of all sorts of stuff.
As far as it can be,
But no. I think you're right. I mean, I think I was speaking to some Americans when I was speaking about this on Tuesday on the media. And, you know, the Ratcliffe is a quite a hawkish fellow. He's been quite strong on Ukraine. He's serious. He's well-respected, I think, on both sides of the House for the Trumpian in his first administration, second administration. And he takes no nonsense. And he's a very serious dude. And I think the Russians know that. So I think what was quite striking for me was the lack of spin from the Russian side or the American side, but in particular the Russian side. They didn't try to make much of it. It was all like, well, we don't know much about this, you know, it's all. And now Naryshkin's come out, the head of the SVR, and said, well, I met my contemporary. But it was quite interesting. Trump's played it down. The Russians have played it down. Mm. It seems to have been done, achieved sensibly without too much slanging, which I then points for me to the seriousness of the issues being discussed. It wasn't just a social call.
Yeah. So what was he there for? Undoubtedly, face to face, it's some sort of warning. He was saying to the Russians, look, this is the situation, you know, so what might he have been warning them about? My first thought was that it was possibly linked to Scott Bessent's economic warfare against Iran, to say to the Russians, you know, the president is serious about this. He will impose sanctions on you if you don't, you know, drop this support to Iran or do it in the same way. That's plausible. I mean, I thought that was more likely to begin with, but the trend of opinion is since then is it may well have been about Russian intentions this autumn in Northern Europe. In other words, don't play games in the Baltics and Poland because we know you're doing it and we've briefed the Poles on this. And it also coincides with something else. About a week ago, we tracked a lot of air assets going into Poland, into Polish airspace, literally between the 17th and the 21st of August. We tracked Typhoons, Poseidon P-8s, tankers, the KC-135s. We tracked A-330s and Apache helicopters, AH-64s, all going into Poland over a three-day period. Now, maybe that was a sort of a spot exercise to see how we reacted. So maybe it was just called as a surprise to see what we could do. But maybe it is some sort of build-up of Allied forces, and it included French, American, British, German forces from around NATO building up in Poland about a week ago, possibly as a signal to the Russians that if you are thinking of playing games in Poland after the election, after your elections, which are the 18th to 20th of September, don't think about it. So if that's part of a trend, then possibly John Ratcliffe was warning Naryshkin to say, look, we know what's happening and we're not going to allow you a free ride to do this. That's possible.
I was there in Moscow when Bill Burns came to Moscow in November 21. And we'd got, before that, we'd had wind within the bounds of classification, but we had wind of something was up. But for me, what really made me sit up was Burns' arrival. Because again, he's like Ratcliffe, Burns was a very serious individual. And for me, that's when we all really focused down on this and said, look, something is definitely up. So again, I think it's serious. I think the Iran, there was multiple explanations, you know, Iran, hostages, on Ukraine about could they negotiate some form of, you know, reduction, escalation to avoid sort of cities being targeted or ranges, perhaps something in there ahead of the winter. And also, as Mike said, about NATO. But all those things can be discussed at the same time. It's not one or either, you know, they can walk and chew gum. The head director of the CIA in talks, you know, these are four things, bang, bang, bang. I think what's interesting for me is there's been an assumption, I think, that among some experts that the US commitment to Europe is waning and that Trump is not interested. And obviously, deterrence is in the eye of the beholder in the Kremlin. So any sign that the US commitment was wavering, or NATO was Europe has become divided, or that there's no credibility of military forces, would weaken deterrence. So I think it's an opportunity for Mr. Ratcliffe to go and say directly to the Russians, that's not true. We stand committed to Article 5 and all the North Atlantic Treaty. That's why we're doing these exercises, and don't do anything daft. But I also think that this is a discussion that Russia may do some cyber attacks. It's already attacking us. You know, it's already got a sophisticated campaign of so-called, you know, hybrid or unconventional warfare. But I think Americans wrote in their own annual threat assessment, they're concerned about a spiral escalation coming out of the war in Ukraine or elsewhere, which they dragged the Americas in. So this was very much the big dog, America, saying to Russia, back in your box, don't do anything daft. We're watching you, and we would react, as we've said we would react, to defend every inch of NATO territory.
And if this was an attempt to maintain deterrence for NATO, it's a cheap way of doing it. Whether the Russians believe it or not, you don't know. But as John said, you know, director to director, and Bill Burns was the last one in 2021, so it hasn't happened for a long time. So it's a signal. It's an easy signal to send and see if the Russians take it seriously.
Well, we know theory is deterrence has to be capable, i.e. military stuff. It has to be credible. You're going to use it. And you have to communicate it clearly to the other side. And I think Burns, these exercises, was saying that to the Russians. But I still think, personally, that the risk of a direct Russian intervention against NATO territory is low. But I think the risk of a probing and testing to probe at our political cohesion, which is the center of gravity of the alliance, is higher. And that's where it's more likely. But every day we strengthen the NATO, we spend more terms, we stand together. Every time, actually, the war in Ukraine goes on, every day that goes on, it weakens Russia's capabilities to attack.
Mike, we talked last week about Russian threats of consequences for the UK for supporting and arming Ukraine, including the possibility of British troops being targeted. There's been some doubling down on that this week too. I just want to share some of the thoughts that we've had from listeners and viewers. Gary Anthony says, British troops are low-hanging fruit for Putin, targeting weapons and drone manufacturers that are producing the technology to attack deeper into Russia would be the strategic choice and also a way to test Article 5. Mike, if some kind of intelligence about something like this was behind the CIA director's visit to Moscow, that would be quite worrying.
Well, in a way, yeah, that's where we are anyway, as John said. I mean, we know we're under pressure all the time on a daily basis. And the Russians are trying to either, you know, inspire kids to have a go for a little bit of money or for the hell of it. They're trying to work with criminal groups to have a go for their own purposes. And in some cases, they've got their own people, their military intelligence operating in the West, also to have a go. So we understand that there's a lot of pressure on cyber, on low-level sabotage. I mean, this week, there's been half a dozen cases across Europe, not as far as I know, in the United Kingdom, but half a dozen cases in Europe of people being arrested. There's two in Slovakia, one in Germany, and they seem to have access to some sort of napalm type of substance, which they look as if they were trying to put into areas or put against the buildings of one of the drone manufacturers in Slovakia. I mean, this is happening all the time. So in a way, that it doesn't test Article 5 quite, because we all say Article 5 is an armed attack. And that's, you know, we've always had this argument in NATO, you know, is a cyber attack an Article 5 attack? And we're never really sure if it is or not. It will depend on what we think as and when it happens. But that's the territory we're already in.
Just a couple more comments to get your thoughts on. This one from Ian Kelly. They would be taking a very grave risk if they attack the UK or its assets, as things could escalate really quickly. A similar sentiment here. Someone said, whatever they try to do will be a public statement. It needs to be very public, something on fire, something they can visibly point to and say, we told you. They might live to regret whatever they try. The retaliation will be thought out and very pointed. Mike, given what you've just said, you know, if we did have, you know, if there was a UK defence site set on fire, for example, what would we actually do? I mean, we've had a Russian assassination attempt with chemical weapons on our territory, and even then, we only responded with sanctions.
Well, everything is context specific, so it would depend on what it is and when it is and so on. The one thing you can guarantee is there's a sort of process here. John will know this very well. Vranyo, the Russian concept of vranyo, which is come from fairy tales, which is to say the Russians will deny it, but they don't want us to believe their denials because they'll want everyone to know it was them because they want to frighten people. And the concept of vranyo is that where you say, here is my explanation. I know you don't believe it, and actually I don't believe it either, but it's my explanation. And so what they would do, they would deny it. They won't expect their denials to be believed. And so they have an official line, deniability, and yes, we, of course, in reality, you know we did it. We know we did it because we're pressuring you. It would depend on the context. So if we're talking about individual sabotage or something like that, I guess we deal with it diplomatically. But mistakes can happen. And it wouldn't be difficult for individual issues to become a mass casualty event. And there might even be planned as a mass casualty event. And that, I would think, instinctively, is where some sort of line will be crossed. Sabotage we can probably live with as criminal activity and dealt with a sort of vranyo explanation by the Russians. But a mistake or something that turns into something that is mass casualty, I think that would be different.
John, I want to talk to you about what you said a few days ago in the Times, that our military channels of communication with Moscow have been closed for 4 years. And since July, we've also been without a Russian ambassador to the UK. How concerning are those facts?
I think we said in the integrated review, even in 2020 or in the refresh, that we had no load-bearing channels of communication with the Russian side. I mean, obviously it takes two to tango. They have to pick the phone up. And we have an embassy and we have a charge d'affaires still in London. But I don't think it's great that two nuclear-armed states in Europe, 3.5 hours apart, don't really talk to each other about military mission matters. And I do think there is a time where you have to hold your nose and speak, like Tony Radican did when he went to Beijing and spoke to the Chinese, or when we brought Ben Wallace and Tony Radican to speak to Shoigu and Gerasimov. And at other times, in the way the Americans and the Russians have done, as I said, you know, away from the glare of publicity to speak on serious issues to manage risk and to control escalation. And unfortunately, they aren't in place. Both sides seem to be happier shouting at each other rather than entering into discussions. I'm not saying it's this way, excusing Russian behavior. It's not about turning a blind eye to Russian mischief. It's about calling them out in private and then setting out the consequences to any what they've been up to. I mean, based on Mike's point, actually, I've seen this, that Russia has been, and the Soviet Union before it, has been trying to undermine and divide us since the 1920s. And it's done, has this sort of campaign of active measures, they call it, or arsons and sabotage, assassinations, political interference, division, disinformation, Zinoviev letters, whatever it is. And I think what Russia's doing is, if it remains an antagonistic and hostile state towards us, this is what should we expect. But I don't think Russia in any way wants to tip this over from, shall we say, this area below Article 5, and not, they might probe it where our responses are, but not to trigger and go over it. Because they know that 33 nations, including the Americans, vastly have greater conventional nuclear and probably nuclear power, and the Russia's a declining state. So I think that's where we're likely to be. Back to Gary's point, it's below armed attack on that area. And unfortunately, people will say, well, if we lose, so we say, a river joint of 20-odd RAF personnel, do we want to go to war with Russia on that? And that's the sort of thing that Russia's trying to test with us.
Okay, well, let's focus back on the battlefield. And Mike, you said last week that the war was becoming worse for Russia. Viktor Roman clearly disagrees, absolute poppycock. He says Ukraine has run out of interceptors and has a chronic manpower deficit. Arguably, war doesn't go well for anyone, but are you still confident that the momentum is with Ukraine, given that, small as they are, the net territorial gains this year are by Russia?
Well, yeah, I don't think I've ever said that the momentum is with Ukraine in any strategic sense. I mean, because we're dealing with a war here that has reached a certain sort of stage where it's about to become a lot more dangerous to everybody else. But I mean, of course, the Ukrainians have a manpower problem, which is structurally different to Russia's. But Russia has a manpower problem as well. I mean, look at what's happening in Russia. And although there is no comparison between the size of Russia and the size of Ukraine, look at where the Russians are at the moment. And I'd say this to Mr. Romain. you know, after 4.5 years of war, this war has lasted longer than the First World War for Russia, longer than the Great Patriotic War against the Nazis. So they're already fighting their longest war for some considerable time, Afghanistan excepted, I suppose. And Russia hasn't achieved any of its strategic objectives, any at all. So it certainly hasn't reabsorbed Ukraine. It hasn't conquered the Donbass. It hasn't diminished NATO. NATO is bigger now and stronger militarily as a result, despite the American attitude to NATO. European NATO is a lot stronger than it was before. Crimea was a comfortable conquest before this war. Now it's a very unpleasant place to have to live and operate in. So Crimea is destabilized. And the Black Sea Fleet has been chased away from Sevastopol and is not even safe at Novorossiysk. So Russia has not achieved a single strategic objective after 4.5 years of war. And its own strategic situation is worse than before it started. Now, that seems to me to, as it were, I was going to say Trump, anything else, that seems to me to overlay any discrepancy in the size of the two countries, because the Russian people are not entirely sure what this war is about, but the Ukrainians are very sure what it is about. They know what this war is about. And although they're having a really hard time, and their time will get harder again this winter, much harder than last winter, which was the hardest that they've ever had. Undoubtedly true, and Mr. Romaine is right about ballistic missile defense. But the Ukrainians are in no mood to give in, and the Russians are wondering why they're fighting.
Tom, a final thought from you. I mentioned earlier that winter is coming, and as Mike has just said, we know that has battlefield effects. What's your assessment of how things will play out over the next 6 months?
Oh, Lord, that's a very, very good question. I mean, I can only sort of really look in, I suppose, my quiet corner of the electromagnetic spectrum and sort of how that's developing and the spectrum conflict. I mean, I think from that score, you're seeing such a rapid uptake of technology by the Ukrainians. I mean, it wouldn't be, you know, it wouldn't be a defense discussion if we didn't mention artificial intelligence. The use by the Ukrainians of AI to interpret and then act on what is happening in the electromagnetic battlefield is impressive, to say the least. Now, the Russians are getting very good at that as well. But if Ukraine can continue on a path towards trying to achieve spectrum dominance, I think that could have quite a tangible effect. I mean, for one thing, it will help degrade Russian air defenses. That's important in getting drone strikes and missile strikes to reach their targets. But it will also help deprive the Russians of access to the spectrum at the tactical and operational level. And what Mike and John were talking about just now, in terms of the reality on the ground and what that looks like, that becomes very important, because when you do have the preponderance of drone warfare that you're seeing, if you can degrade the other side's use of drones through EW, but also you can degrade their command and control links and that kind of thing, this can have a force multiplying effect as you're beginning to think about what you're going to do with the ground war. So it's a bit long-winded, but that's how I see the battle in the spectrum, certainly in the next few months.
John, there's talk of fresh mobilization on both sides. Former US envoy Keith Kellogg has even suggested Ukraine should start mobilizing women, though that doesn't appear to be on the cards. But how likely do you think we are to see new mobilizations? If so, you know, how much difference could it make?
Well, I think on the Ukrainian side, that's for the Ukrainian people, because of the size of the population and the nature of this sort of distribution. But I think there's no doubt the Ukrainians need to squeeze more manpower out of their population. And whether that includes women to free up men for the front, that's what we did in the First and Second World War. That would be a great tactic. I think on the Russian side, Russia's been mobilizing since 2022 when they first did the first wave. It never went away. They've just done it in a slightly different way. So you see a lot of discussion about, you know, a quote, mass mobilization. But actually, I think the Kremlin's been very reluctant to do that. And the model has been to sort of use a private mobilization. I had to pay people to volunteer, and they're still getting people through the door. And I think the political risks to Putin of full mobilization, which is more than just people, it's like state mobilization, transfer of private companies into state side, you know, back to a much more command economy, spending much, much more on defense than they are at the moment, you know, maybe up to half of the GDP rather than just whatever it is at the moment, 10%, I think probably mitigates against a large scale formal mobilization. What you'll see is a sort of rolling mobilization on reserves and using conscripts and North Koreans and the Russian National Guard to free up troops for the front.
Mm-hmm. Mike, a final thought from you. We're always looking for a tipping point and one that would be in Ukraine's favour. Do you see any chance of that on the battlefield as we head towards winter?
Not particularly on the battlefield, as we said before. I think the Ukrainians have got to keep on holding on. But I think it's not a tipping point, but an inflection point, let's say, because this war has now become a war of the battle of the homelands, both sides bombarding each other's homeland, and that takes it into different territory altogether. Both sides know that they can't do that indefinitely, and therefore it will affect the way everybody else reacts. It will affect the way Russia's backers, particularly China, thinks about the war, and it certainly affects the way the Europeans are prepared to back or not Ukraine. So I think the war is entering different political territory, because strategically now it's become a sort of bombardment of the homelands, which probably will become more severe now that both sides know how to make lethal drones cheaply and in high numbers.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you also to John Foreman and Dr. Thomas Withington. We really appreciate your analysis on all of that. That's all for now. Professor Michael Clark will, of course, be back with Kate Gibeau for another SITREP next Thursday. Between now and then, please do get in touch with any of your thoughts or questions. Just drop us a comment wherever you get the podcast, or you can email us sitrep@bfbs.com. But for now, for me, Sian Greshchek-Melbourne, thank you very much indeed for joining us.